23. Martin didn't wake up so much as he gradually became less unconscious. At first, he didn't know who he was, where he was, or what he was doing. Then he figured out that he was Martin Banks, he was in medieval England, and that he was struggling at the ropes with which someone had tied him to, respectively, Jeff, Gary, and a tree. It was dusk, and Martin was seated on the ground with his back resting against the tree trunk and his legs stretched out in front of him, bound together with heavy rope at the knees, ankles, and the arches of his feet. Although he could only see their feet in his peripheral vision, he knew Jeff was on one side of him and Gary was on the other, both in the same position. Their arms were all intertwined as if they were out for a grand day in a musical in the 1930s. Martin's hands were bound together by a length of rope that was pulled tight just to the point of causing him constant discomfort. Another thick rope lashed Martin's back to the tree. Another held his neck to the tree. And a final thick and well-used rope was tied tight around his head, holding his mouth open, effectively gagging him.
"Whoever has us," Martin thought, "it's someone who isn't suffering a shortage of rope."
Martin could feel Jeff and Gary struggling just like he was. They were helpless, lashed to a tree beside one of the buildings that used to make up the town of Rickard's Bend. Whoever attacked them was wise to take them by surprise, disarming them of their staffs and Jeff his wand immediately. Without their staffs, the shell wouldn't recognize them as wizards and allow them to use their powers. On the bright side, no matter how hard his captors tried, unless they put on a very specific robe and hat and knew some Esperanto, they'd never get the staffs to do magic for them, either. Also, the staffs were unbreakable thanks to the shell, so that was something. Martin could feel that his hat was still on his head. Glancing down to his robe's pocket, it looked like his imp box was still there, meaning his smartphone would still be inside. The staffs, and to a lesser extent the wizards themselves, were being guarded by a single person. He appeared to be young, a teenager, Martin figured. The guard was standing with his back to Martin, watching what was going on in the distance, and Martin couldn't blame him. There was a massive bonfire surrounded by young men. There was a sort of band playing something approximating music. One guy was pounding on a crude drum, and another was playing some sort of stringed instrument that was completely drowned out by a huge bruiser blowing with all of his might into some sort of horn. Martin knew instantly that it was Kluge. He sounded awful, but Martin didn't want to be the one to tell him that. Many other young males were gathered around the bonfire. Some were dancing. Some were fighting. It was hard to tell which was which. Martin thought it actually looked like a pretty good party until two guys hauled the body of a dead villager into view, then chucked it onto the fire. Martin was relieved to see Gwen sitting on a stump, well away from the fire, but also far away from the wizards. She didn't seem to be tied up, and nobody seemed to be threatening her at the moment. She didn't look happy either, sullenly examining her measuring stick, probably as an excuse to not make eye contact with her captors. Martin had attended many parties and seen many attractive girls do the same thing. Martin took stock of the situation. He, Gary, and Jeff were helpless. Gwen was surrounded and outnumbered. Their captors had demonstrated a willingness to use violence, and he hazily remembered them saying that they blamed wizards for what had happened here. All in all, Martin thought the situation was grim, but not hopeless. If he could get one hand free, he could get to his smartphone, and with one button press, he could escape. Once he was gone, he'd have the time to plan and prepare and come back for the others.
"No, actually, if I press that button, I'll be deposited back at my parents' house right as the cops bust in," he realized. "I'd probably still be tied up. At least I'd be dressed. That's something, I guess."
Martin made a mental inventory of the smartphone app's other functions and cursed himself for not having reprogrammed it to do any of the new things he'd learned. Still, he could teleport. It wasn't a one-button process, but if he got a few seconds and a free hand, he could put several hundred yards between himself and his captors. That would buy him time to teleport somewhere useful. Then he could come back and rescue the others. First things first, though. He couldn't do anything until he was at least partially untied, and that would mean talking to the guard, gaining his confidence, and conning him into offering some assistance.
Time to turn on the old Martin Banks charm, Martin thought, and then winced at how bad it sounded, even in his own head. Martin cleared his throat, which, with the rope in his mouth, sounded like he was gagging. Then Martin said, "Hello," which, with the rope in his mouth, also sounded like he was gagging. Then Martin gagged. The guard heard the third gagging noise and jumped. The guard turned, as if he was afraid of what he would see when he looked at the wizards. At first it was hard to see the guard's face because of the lack of ambient light and the bright bonfire silhouetting him. But once his eyes adjusted, Martin was shocked to see that his guard was Donald Melick, the younger, the boy he had recently helped exercise. Donnie cringed. Then he looked back to the bonfire and all of the young men there and cringed again. He backed toward where the wizards were bound to the tree, watching the gang around the fire the whole time. Finally, he crouched next to Martin and quickly turned to face him.
"I'm so sorry about this," he said. "I wanted to tell him that I knew you and that you were all right, but that would have been dumb."
Martin couldn't argue with that.
"One of the guys is from this village. He came out to threaten his family, maybe steal some food. He comes running back to Kluge and says everyone's dead and they all look weird. Well, Kluge says he doesn't believe it and he wants to see it for himself."
Maybe we were wrong about this Kluge person, Martin thought.
"So 4 or 5 of us get here, and it's like he said, everyone's dead. Kluge says it's the best thing he's ever seen."
"Nope," Martin thought.
"Someone said that it didn't look like there was any fighting, so it must have been magic that killed everyone. And Kluge starts talking about how he's never liked wizards or anybody else, but particularly wizards. He says he won't have anybody going around wiping out towns and not inviting him. He got everyone all worked up. They wanted to go find the first wizard they could and do something awful. Well, I know you and Philip are okay, so I said they'd never work. I told them that wizards are dangerous. It was pretty easy to convince them since we were surrounded by the bodies of folks killed by a wizard. I told them the only way we'd ever get the best of a wizard would be to catch him by surprise. I just about had him convinced to give it up. Then we see you lot appear on that hill over there, and well, you look pretty easy to surprise."
"I bet we did," Martin thought. "They probably had just enough time to hide before we got our bearings. In retrospect, explicitly telling Kluge that my staff made me undefeatable was probably a bad move."
"Once you were knocked out, a couple of the guys wanted to kill you straight away, but Kluge says we should tie you up and let you sit a while."
"He wants us to sit here and worry," Martin thought. "Now I understand this Kluge guy. I know how he thinks."
"He says he wants to give time for your flavors to meld."
Martin made a mental note to stop assuming he understood anybody. Donnie looked furtively over his shoulder at the chaos around the bonfire. Kluge appeared to be playing the drum and the horn at the same time by hitting the drum with the horn. It would have been quite impressive if it hadn't sounded like a small animal being kicked repeatedly. Donnie said,
"The guys tried to use your staffs to make magic, but it didn't work. So now they're just carrying them around, trying to look all fearsome and impressive. Well, that's not working either."
Now that he was looking for them, Martin could see that a couple of the brutes near the bonfire were wielding his staff with its bust of Santo and Gary's with its Kiss action figures. There was one guy with what might have been Jeff's wand, or might have just been a stick. It was hard to tell unless you could get close enough to see the word Wonder Boy carved into its shaft. Donnie took his eyes off of the fire and leaned in closer to Martin.
"Look,"
he said quietly.
"Kluge told me to tell him as soon as you lot woke up. I'm really sorry about all this. I'm going to try and think of a way to get you out of it, but I have a family and Kluge knows where they live. I'm only still hanging around with him, so I can fade away slowly instead of just not showing up one day. You understand, don't you?"
Martin gagged as affirmatively as he could. Donnie looked equal parts pleased and worried. He reluctantly rose to his full height, turned his back to the 3 helpless wizards, and yelled,
"Oi, Kluge! The evil wizards is awake! Can we kill him now?"
He glanced down at Martin, who was glaring up at him.
"Sorry, I had to make it convincing."
Then he kicked Martin. Kluge couldn't hear anything over the sound of his own demented horn playing, but one of the oafs yelled in his ear and the music stopped abruptly. Kluge approached with the slow, deliberate gait of a man who enjoys the fact that people don't want him to approach them. Somewhere between 15 and 20 more thugs followed behind. Martin assumed that when word got out that Kluge had captured 3 wizards, like-minded flunkies had started coming out of the woodwork. None of them seemed to have swords or knives, which didn't surprise or comfort Martin. Swords were designed to kill quickly and easily. Kluge seemed like the type who'd rather do it the slow, difficult way, with tools he crafted himself. An old-fashioned purveyor of artisanal pain. A man who takes his time and pays attention to the details. A man who hurts people for the love of the craft. Gwen rose from her seat and had walked half the distance to where Martin sat before one of the thugs thought to grab her arm and force her to walk to where Martin sat. Soon the thugs had crowded around, leaving about a 10-foot clearing around the wizards to form a natural stage for Kluge to do whatever he intended to do. Donnie was still standing nearby. He was trying to act like a proud bird dog that had presented his master with a dead pheasant, but Martin wasn't fooled. The boy wasn't a very good actor, but he was good enough to fool Kluge.
"Well, well, well," Kluge said. "Looks like our guests have finally decided to wake up."
Kluge was alarmingly tall and broad. His scraggly black hair had grown in a bit since the last time Martin was this close to him. He reached into the crowd and snatched Martin's staff from one of the gang. Kluge was wearing a chainmail shirt he'd most likely stolen from someone who had learned that an armored shirt doesn't save you from a punch in the face. Just standing next to him on the street had intimidated Martin. Sitting on the ground, tied helplessly to a tree at his feet, Martin was terrified. Kluge loomed over them like death itself, and he clearly knew it.
"Where's the girlfriend?"
Kluge asked. Gwen was shoved roughly to the front of the crowd. She stumbled, but caught herself before she fell. She didn't look at the wizards. Martin thought she probably didn't want to give Kluge and his buddies the satisfaction, or perhaps she didn't want to give them an idea where to start. Kluge stooped down to one knee, leaning a bit on Martin's staff. Even then, he towered over the wizards.
"Sorry, we had to be rough with you three, but we couldn't have you turning us into toads or nothing. It stands to reason that if you could do any magic all tied up and gagged like that, you would have by now. So that means we've got you. And if you want to go back to your homes and hang upside down like a bat or whatever it is you freaks do, you're gonna have to do what I say. Now, I'm gonna have the runt take one of your gags out, and whichever one of you is lucky enough to get to talk is gonna tell me how to do what was done to the people in this here town. And if you don't, I'm gonna do something pretty bad to this young lady here."
Martin glanced at Gwen. The thug standing behind her was a head taller and a full Gwen width wider than her on each side. He had the dull eyes and broad smile of a born follower. He was the type of person who mistook being large for being tough for being strong, and being strong for being smart. He saw that Martin was looking their way, so he put a hand on Gwen's shoulder. It was a reassuring gesture, in that it was meant to reassure Martin that he had no qualms about doing any number of things that Gwen would not like. She had pulled up her hood. Only her mouth, set in a grim scowl, was visible. Her hands were slowly working their way up her measuring stick.
"Poor thing," Martin thought. "She's probably not even aware she's doing it. I've got to think of a way to get her out of this. She was just in the wrong place at the wrong time."
It was a nasty jolt to Martin when he realized that the wrong place was in close proximity to wizards, or more specifically, him. Kluge looked at the 3 wizards, deciding whose gag he would remove. He poked whoever was tied on Martin's left with Martin's stolen staff. Martin couldn't turn his head and could only see the man on his left's boots, but was not surprised to hear Gary's voice.
"If I were going to pick someone to tell me how to use magic to hurt people, I'd go for the one wearing black too,"
he thought. After a deep breath, Gary said,
"Let's get something straight. If you hurt the girl, we tell you nothing."
Kluge smiled. He had a few teeth missing, and the condition of the ones he had gave the impression that the missing teeth were the lucky ones.
If we hurt the girl, you tell us nothing. Voluntarily. If we hurt her enough, one of you might crack. If none of you talks, then we move on to you. We hurt you enough, I bet it'll loosen someone's tongue. If not, we move on to the dandy.
Kludge said, then kicked Martin, who was now regretting his shiny silver robe and hat. Kludge looked at Jeff with great relish.
By the time we get around to this one, I'm betting he'll be ready to talk.
He won't talk, Gary said. None of us will, and you'll spend hours torturing us for nothing.
Martin rolled his eyes. He didn't blame Gary. Martin couldn't think of anything better to say, but threatening these guys with the prospect of having to spend a lot of time hurting people was like threatening an avid golfer with hours and hours of playing golf. Kludge kept his eyes on Gary, but tilted his head toward Gwen and the slab of beef with his hand on her shoulder, and said,
Percy, hurt the girl.
Everyone's eyes, Martin's included, turned to Gwen, who was holding her measuring stick tightly with both hands. Because her hood was pulled up, Martin could not see her eyes, but she clearly did not want what was about to happen. The bully behind her grinned like a delighted child as he put his other massive hand on her other shoulder and started to squeeze and twist. There was a sickening dry snap, followed by a ripping noise. Everyone who heard it winced involuntarily. Martin's impulse was to look away, but he couldn't. He was frozen with disbelief at what he was seeing. Gwen had snapped her measuring stick in half. Then in one smooth, clearly rehearsed motion, hooked her thumbs into the sleeves of her cloak and pulled them apart, ripping a seam that had held the sleeves tight to her arms. With the seam destroyed, the cuffs widened to a loose flare. When Gwen held the two halves of her measuring stick up in front of her, it was clear to Martin that they were now two magic wands. For the first time, it occurred to Martin that the exaggerated taper of the hood on Gwen's cloak might not be purely decorative. Later, Martin, Jeff, and Gary would discuss Gwen's salutation. The whole idea of a salutation is to make it plain to anyone who sees it that you do have magical powers and that you should not be messed with. They all agreed that Gwen's was probably the best salutation they had ever seen. And what made it so effective was its subtlety. All salutations were triggered by a specific action or phrase. It could be anything. Philip hummed a tune. Martin, in a failed attempt to amuse Philip, yelled the magic words that Apache chief from Super Friends would use to grow huge. Gwen shouted,
"No!"
Once triggered, a good salutation would demonstrate the wizard's power by doing something that normal people could not do, and which could not be faked. Philip flew. Martin grew into a giant statue. Gwen emitted a single blinding pulse of white light, like a human-sized flashbulb. At that moment, Percy, the thug who was touching her, flew 20 feet back and bounced off of a wall. The salutation itself made no sound. The people watching made plenty of noise on their own. After the initial flash of a salutation was complete, most of them employed some continuing effect to remind onlookers of the wizard's fearsome power. Philip hovered in the air and emitted a blue glow. Martin, now to his embarrassment, had breakdanced. Faint but unmistakable waves of energy were radiating from Gwen with blistering speed. It looked as if anyone who got their hand too close would see the flesh ripped from their skeleton. Her hood had tipped back slightly. Her face was visible. She had murder in her eyes. She aimed the wand in her right hand at Kludge and muttered something under her breath. Kludge immediately shot into the air, shrieking like a little girl and dropping Martin's staff as he went. He hung helplessly in the air above the heads of his awestruck gang. One of the thugs made a half-hearted move toward Martin's staff, which was now lying on the ground, but all it took was Gwen silently pointing her second wand at him, and he sheepishly withdrew back into the group.
"Now," she said quietly through gritted teeth, "you idiots are going to untie these idiots, or I throw that idiot into the fire."
The bravest of Kludge's gang said,
"Girlie, you can kill Kludge, but you can't kill all of us before we swarm you."
Gwen tried to answer, but couldn't be heard over Kludge, screaming threats and obscenities at his gang. She sighed and with a flick of her wrist caused Kludge to gain altitude. His voice became more distant and more shrill.
As I was about to say, yes, I can kill all of you where you stand, but I didn't say I was going to kill anyone, not even him. I'm going to throw him on the fire, then get the wizards out of here whether you untie them or not, leaving you all here with an angry burned Klooge looking to take his pain out on someone, and who knows that none of you did anything to save him when you could.
They looked up at Klooge, who was still raining down curses on their heads. Immediately, the mood of the crowd shifted, and it was clear to all that Gwen was going to get her way. Donnie leapt to untie the wizards before anyone told him to. Martin picked up his staff. Jeff and Gary were given their wand and staff back. Gwen maneuvered Klooge so that he was floating over a tall tree. She stowed her second wand in her pocket and put her hand on Jeff's shoulder. He put his hand on Gary's shoulder, and Gary put his hand on Martin's.
All right,
Gwen said.
We're gonna go now. Consider yourselves warned. Next time any of you gives any wizard a hard time, we won't be so gentle.
Martin quickly grabbed Donnie, put him in a headlock, and touched his staff to the young man's temple. Martin yelled,
Yeah! And to make sure none of you primitive screwheads tries to follow us, we're taking this run hostage, see?
The crowd of thugs listened to Martin in silence, then turned in unison to see what Gwen would say to that. She shook her head slightly.
Ah, whatever.
She looked up at the still screaming Klooge and said,
Faligis,
which caused him to fall quickly into and then slowly through the tree, bouncing off the branches as he went. While everyone was watching that, she said,
Transporti al plumba pregeo.
And the five of them disappeared. Not far away, the lead-covered chapel that gave the town of Lead Church its name was an island of tradition and tranquility. Its thick walls and solid foundation gave a sense of peace and solace to the faithful who were sitting in the pews, communing with the Almighty. Their faith, like their church, was unchanging and serene. Then four wizards and a hostage materialized in front of the altar and immediately started yelling at each other.
How long have you been a wizard?
Martin asked.
That's a stupid question, Gwen said.
Yes, it is,
Gary said to Martin before turning to Gwen and saying,
Answer the stupid question.
I started about a week ago, Gwen said, sneering. I figured if you fools could do it, I might as well give it a shot. By the way, none of you carry a secret wand hidden somewhere in your clothes. Really?
I have one, Jeff said. It's in my pants.
Don't make the obvious joke,
the other three said in unison.
No, really, it's one of those old school collapsible pointers. I just couldn't get to it because he tied us up.
Jeff pointed his wand at Donnie, who asked politely if he could be released from Martin's headlock. Gary asked,
How'd they know to take our staffs away anyhow? We don't go around just telling people our weakness.
Where are we?
Martin asked, changing the subject. He'd walked past the church, but had never seen the inside.
We're in the lead church,
Gary said, before asking Gwen,
Why on earth did you bring us here?
A voice from the back of the pews bellowed,
I'd like to know that myself!
The authority in the voice made all four of the wizards freeze. It also made Donnie freeze, but he was already in a headlock and was fairly immobile. Silently, they looked to the back of the room and saw a flustered-looking nun standing next to Bishop Galbraith. A moment passed, then all five of them started frantically explaining all at once. The bishop listened to the unintelligible chatter for a moment before shouting,
This is the Lord's house, and I am his representative here on earth. And I swear, if you don't all shut up and behave yourselves, I will see to it that you meet him personally.
They all went to Bishop Galbraith's quarters to discuss things like mature adults, because an older authority figure had ordered them to.
Why on earth did you decide to take a hostage?
Gwen asked.
Oh, I know Donnie. He's a good guy. He just got caught up in the wrong crowd. Isn't that right, Donnie?
Donnie nodded a little too quickly, as if he thought he might still be caught up in the wrong crowd.
Well, now you're free of him, Martin said. Lie low for a few hours, then go home. If Klooge or any of his friends ever shows up asking questions, tell them that we were flying low over some trees and you jumped for it and hid. Then tell them that you don't want to hang around with them anymore because not one of them lifted a finger to rescue you.
But what if they're out there trying to save me right now?
Donnie asked. After a long silence, he said,
Yeah, right. Never mind.
Donnie thanked the wizards, made his excuses, and got out of there. After he left, Bishop Galbraith gave Martin a look that said,
"I'm impressed, but don't expect me to ever tell you that."
With the hostage issue off the table, the next order of business was explaining to Bishop Galbraith why they were there. He sat behind his desk as they stood, like naughty children meeting with the principal. They explained what Gwen had found in Rikard's Bend, and how she had brought the others in to have a look. They told him how they had ended up in the clutches of Kluge and his band of oafs. They glossed over who had teleported them to the church. They all knew it was best to discuss that when the bishop was not around. Instead, they discussed why they'd come to the church at all.
"It seemed like the safest place to hide out and come up with a plan,"
Gwen explained.
"On account of churches having to offer sanctuary,"
Jeff said.
"I don't have to offer you anything, son,"
the bishop snorted.
"It's the last place Kluge would ever come looking for us,"
Gwen said.
"Yep, 'cause the church hates us wizards,"
Jeff said.
"I do not hate, boy. Not wizards or anyone else. Though there are some wizards that I dislike. More so by the minute,"
the bishop replied.
"No, Kluge won't come looking for you here at my church, because doing so would mean coming to my church, and he'll look everywhere else before he resorts to that. Besides, I expect you don't plan to stay here very long."
"You're right," Martin said. "Rikard's Bend has to be dealt with. We've got to figure out exactly who did that and how we can stop them from doing it again."
It was clear, even to the bishop, who hadn't even been there, that the mass killing at Rikard's Bend was the work of a wizard. Martin and Gary had remained silent about their speculation that someone was trying to make hobbits.
"So then,"
Bishop Galbraith said,
"is there a wizard any of you know who is capable of this? Someone who's secretive? Some wizard who is probably in this area and has had time to himself to do something of this scale?"
Gwen and the bishop were silent. They had nothing to say. Martin, Jeff, and Gary were also silent. They had something they didn't want to say. They looked at the floor. They looked at each other. They looked at Gwen and the bishop. Gwen and the bishop looked back at them, and they quickly looked at the floor. The bishop bared his teeth and blurted,
"Out with it!"
Martin sighed and reluctantly said,
"Well, there's Philip."
An eternity seemed to pass. The room was silent. The only sound was a faint, distant dog snarling at something. Martin wondered if there were any friendly dogs in this town. Finally, the bishop spoke.
"Well, it's clearly not Philip. Who else?"
Martin, Gary, and Jeff shrugged at each other. Martin said,
"I don't want to believe it either."
"Good,"
Bishop Galbraith said.
"I give you permission not to. Who else could it be?"
Martin said,
"Philip fits perfectly. He lives nearby. He's as powerful a wizard as anybody. He has a whole floor of his shop that nobody's allowed to see. He disappears up there and refuses to talk about what he does. I hate to say it, but it fits."
Gwen gave Martin a long, penetrating look before saying,
"He's right."
Martin was relieved.
"It's not Philip,"
Gwen continued.
"Who else could it be?"
Martin reflected on the fact that his feelings of relief were increasingly fleeting.
"Look," Martin said, "I'm not saying Philip did it."
"Nobody is, so let's move on,"
the bishop said.
"But,"
Martin said,
"we have to rule him out."
"Fine. He's ruled out. Who else could have done it?"
the bishop said. Martin sputtered uselessly for a moment, then composed himself.
"I don't want to think that Philip did this. I don't believe he did this, but we have to be sure."
"I am sure,"
the bishop said.
"I've known Philip for 10 years. That's a lot longer than I've known any of you."
The bishop paused and looked at Gwen.
"Actually, I've known you a little longer than that, haven't I?"
she replied,
"something like that,"
and actively avoided eye contact with anyone.
"Well, I've known Philip a long time, and while I don't like what you wizards do, I like Philip. I trust Philip. I know he'd never hurt another person, and he'd never take the chance of accidentally hurting another person. And if you, his apprentice, don't understand that, then I have to wonder if I can have the same faith in you. Now, if you ask me, and I notice you haven't, I'd say you take a good long look at that weasel Merlin up in Camelot. He can't be trusted.
Martin wasn't surprised to hear Merlin slash Jimmy's name slash names brought up, but he didn't think much of it. Jimmy was capable of wrongdoing, but only small, silly wrongdoing. He was far too obvious a villain to try to get away with anything truly sinister. No, this was obviously the work of the last person you'd suspect, and that meant they had to investigate Philip. Martin looked around the room for support and found none. The bishop was yelling at him. Gwen was glaring at him. Gary and Jeff were silently staring at the floor. Even the angry dog in the distance seemed to be growling louder.
"Listen to me," Martin said. "I know that Philip would never deliberately hurt another person, even if that person was trying to hurt him. It's not in him. But he is human, Father. We wizards are only human. And it's entirely possible that Philip has made a mistake. I don't think he has, but none of us can honestly say that we know he hasn't. And if we don't at least go and ask him, everyone in this room will always wonder. And that's not fair to Philip."
In the long silence that followed, Martin noted that everyone in the room seemed to have gotten angrier, which he took as a sign that he had won the argument.